Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Beckwith, the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association. Welcome to the 10th briefing by the Baker-Polito administration to local government municipal chief executive officers during the COVID-19 public health crisis. I apologize for the slightly delayed start today. We are overlapping with the administration's daily briefing to the press that is wrapping up right now. Lieutenant Governor will be joining us very shortly. I have a couple of announcements, and then we hope to have Commissioner of Education Jeff Riley on in just a moment to give an update on the graduation announcements that came out regarding the safe graduation ceremonies and the protocol that was established by the Commonwealth and released late last week. First, I want to just make note to everyone here that there will be a second webinar being held this week, hosted by the MMA and produced by the administration. This webinar will be focusing on state programs that to help communities address the economic challenges of COVID-19. The invitation was sent to all municipal chief executive officers on May 21st, and the webinar is scheduled for 1 p.m. on Thursday, May 28th. This program will include presentations by members of the staff at the Executive Office of Housing and Economic Development, talking about the way that cities and towns can access grant programs, primarily focusing on the non-entitlement communities' ability to access about $20 million in CDBG funds that were included as part of the CARES Act that was adopted by Congress and signed by the President. So that special seminar, that webinar being put on is also to help provide guidance as communities are applying for the funds. The deadline is next week. I believe it's June 5th to apply for the funds. And so the officials will help provide key information as you of funding was issued back a couple of weeks ago. So again, mark your calendars for 1 p.m. on Thursday, May 28th for that special community development, economic development webinar that's being put on by the administration. In the meantime, I'm going to check to see whether or not we have Roe. The good news is the Lieutenant Governor is back from the briefing that was just held. And so we'll start with her as the Commissioner of Education is also trying to hook up into the meeting. But it's our pleasure to welcome the Lieutenant Governor of the Commonwealth, Karen Polito, who has been providing outstanding communication to local government officials throughout this crisis. Lieutenant Governor, welcome and thank you for being with us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Be with everyone. I know the Commissioner Riley is expected, if he's not here already, which I'd like to have him come on and present because he has a 1:30, I believe, stop. So if he does come in, can we coordinate that with whoever is coordinating the call? We also have Secretary Theoharides, and I do see the Assistant Secretary Aishan here as well. She wants to give you an update. But before that, let me just give you a few updates. And then, of course, the meat of the call comes with your questions, the chat, and things that we want to follow up on. So first of all, the Community Compact Program is available to you in our municipalities. It's currently accepting applications, and we encourage you to apply by mid-June. This could be helpful to you as you begin to reopen and have to make adjustments, and these funds might be able to help you adopt some best practices in your operation. And if you have any questions, Sean Cronin is available for that. Reopening, we're living through phase one, and you have also been briefed on the allowed and eligible uses as well as activities in phase one. And we continue to provide you guidance for clarity purposes and as we receive information. So on the reopening website, you will see an update that addresses, for instance, golf and being able to have the restaurant open in the clubhouse while the golf is under their own separate guidance. Yesterday, with retail at curbside starting, there was an update there and what that included. Auto dealerships as well as outdoor fitness and charter boats. So those were some just specific things that the guidance is on the reopening website. You can go there and read that to give you more clarity. On June 1, which is less than a week away, the mayor of Boston is eligible to open offices. You may receive more guidance if you fall into that category from their office. In terms of phase one, a lot of you raised the question around summer camps and childcare. I've said on this call before, and there he is. If you want to transition, we can to the commissioner before I talk about phase two. That guidance is coming this week. So I think that can be very helpful for these programs, but also the guidance can be used for you as municipal leaders to incorporate into your own municipal summer camp opportunities. You may end up having questions for Commissioner Riley around Chapter 70 or school opening in the fall, but I do know that he has the graduation guidance that he wants to review with you, and I'll turn that over to Commissioner Riley now.
I'll unmute you. Here we go. And there we go. There you go, Commissioner. Welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate the opportunity to speak about high school graduations. I know this has been a really hard time for families. Being at home doing remote learning, it's been particularly hard for our seniors who have missed out on prom and so many of the events that come with graduation. And so we were doing everything in our power to try to offer some form of graduation ceremonies that also work within kind of the ground rules of safety and health for our families and students. And what we've been able to come up with is kind of a bifurcated approach where there are districts that are graduating high school seniors in the month of June, and they're allowed to do that virtually or in some extreme other circumstances using, safety protocols, fairly extreme social distancing, things like car parades and the like. And what happens for those people trying to graduate now, our guidance, which came from the Department of Public Health, basically says that districts should work with their municipal local boards of health or their health board officer to get approval for whatever graduation is taking place in June to see if it meets the standards. And if it does, we've been told that local enforcement will decide whether it's fair or foul, and then districts can proceed with that type of graduation. For instance, many high schools are doing kind of a car parade graduation where students and their families are in cars and they line up together and they celebrate in that way. And so that has been something that's been allowed to happen. And there are a few variations on that. So what I would say is, if your district is doing that, great. Just remind them to check with the local Board of Health or the appropriate representative on health. Otherwise, other districts, not as many, have held out to see if something could be done in July and August. And beginning July 19th, after July 18th, there will be an opportunity for more in-person graduation events to be held. However, again, there are some pretty strict rules around social distancing, and I'm going to just list a few of them so people understand, how serious this is being taken. Districts are asked to kind of keep the number of participants to a minimum. That includes family members only. They're asked to keep anyone that has an underlying health condition or elderly or small children are at home. Districts are being asked to really manage the list of who's coming and not. And when they do that, those groups of families will be allowed to sit together in small groups, and they should be 6 feet apart from the next group of family or what have you. So there should always be 6 feet of distance between any kind of family pod that happens while doing this scenario. But there's several other important things that we want to have happen. We want the districts to treat this like a semi-military operation and really think through everything from arrival and exiting of both families and students to keep as much social distance as possible. We want to make sure that the graduates stay in a single line and they themselves are 6 feet apart. We want to make sure there's appropriate signage available so everyone kind of knows the rules. And, you know, if there's one-way signs or one-way aisles, those need to be properly demarcated. We should have staff who'll be helping to direct people to make sure that social distancing is maintained. Should be no handshakes or hugging. I know this is kind of a sad part of the ceremony. I mean, obviously within the family that's permissible, but among staff or students that or school committee members, that is not something we're looking to do. And we're looking for really people to have an idea of what the setup will be of the graduation before they come. I'm trying to give as much information to parents as possible so they know what to expect. Right. What we don't ever want to do is have families be caught off guard by some of the rules and regulations. For instance, we're not allowing food of any kind or drinks of any kind in the ceremony. That's something we want parents to know. There are, are we going to do every other row seating? There are definitely different directives that people are going to give to families. And we want to make sure that information gets out sooner rather than later so that everyone kind of knows the ground rules they're going into. Obviously, cleaning is a big part of the graduation ceremony, both before and after and maybe even in between. And so that is something that is going to be spelled out and that people need to pay attention to. The venue needs to have sufficient access to sanitizers with at least a 60% or above alcohol content. No hugging rule, no handshaking rule is in effect. And we want ceremonies to be as brief as possible. We're not trying to be downers during this time. On the other hand, we want to try to keep people as safe as possible so that bigger problems don't arrive. And those are kind of the big picture items that we have as far as what a graduation can look like after July 18th. Obviously, and I want to be clear about this, we think, and I think the numbers have been bearing out, that things are getting better. But as always, we reserve the right, if something were to happen, if there was a second spike, to change some of the guidance going forward if need be. I don't know if folks have questions, but.
And as usual during this webinar, we will be taking questions via the chat function and I'll attempt to direct them to the appropriate person. There is a question just generally regarding guidance on school reopening timing as well. That's a little harder for you, I'm sure, to address. But that is topical, and we know that you have a tight timeline, so it would be good to if you could share the latest thinking and timing.
Sure. So we are following the administration's guidance, and we are we have been working since the reopen, even before the reopening, frankly, for what the fall could look like for schools, but also the potential for summer school, right? We are hopeful that in the next phase that some summer programming will be allowed. If that is the case, we certainly have been working diligently on our guidance. That should be available by early next week in the hopes that we can do something in July. For fall guidance, we expect to have a draft available around the middle of June, preferably before schools get out, but so that people have several months of planning time to figure out what that looks like. Again, recognizing that things could change over the summer, but we want to have a plan in place so that people understand what's happening. I mean, you know, obviously some of the obvious things are going to be, you should expect more likely than not that we're going to have children wearing masks and staff members wearing masks when we initially start, right? You should expect social distancing to play a factor in what reopening can look like. But we're also really being thoughtful both about what's happening in other countries in the world and how they're opening up schools, many of which have opened up before us, to see what's worked and what's not. And we've also been really thoughtful around establishing a working group made up of approximately 40 individuals, many stakeholders in education, from students to parents to teachers to principals to superintendents, school committee members, industry council representatives, to also offer some recommendations. And they've been meeting since earlier this month, and that those meetings continue into June. And so we're really trying to be as thoughtful as possible so that our guidance is solid and really allows us to move forward in the fall.
Let me, I'll just check to see if there are any more directly education related questions before we hand it back to the Lieutenant Governor. I don't see any at this stage. I do think that frequent updates will be helpful because communities are just anxious to be able to plan accordingly. Commissioner, thank you so much for your...
Happy to come back at any time. Obviously, if there's other questions, people can reach out to me directly. We want to be a resource and make sure we get the information out. I think, optimistic about a return to school. I know the teachers and principals are dying to get back and see the kids, and I think the kids are ready to get back as well. So hopefully we're going to be able to get there, and we certainly have the planning underway to do so.
Commissioner, there are a number of questions around Chapter 70 funding. Obviously, that's something that is addressed through the budgeting process with the legislature.
Yeah.
If there's anything further you would like to add there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, obviously we're in a little bit of time of uncertainty. I think the governor's budget came out before the pandemic hit. And then both the House and Senate Ways and Means chairs said afterwards, we're not going to be able to use this as a template. We're going to have to go back kind of the drawing board and see where we are with revenues. And so obviously in typical days, schools have kind of their budgets ready to go in June. We recognize that on Beacon Hill, the timing may be delayed. We know that, tax returns, have been delayed. And so how much revenue people have is still up in the air. And so we're going to work closely with Beacon Hill to try to figure that out and what impact it will have on schools. There has been some federal CARES money, which tracks closely to Title I, that is in the process of being distributed by the department right now. My hope has been that that money will be supplemental and not money that will be need to fill in a pothole or supplant the dollars at the state. But we have to be realistic about what this budget could look like going forward. There's different projections on how big the deficit will be and what impact that will have on schools is a little bit unknown now. So, what we've said is we're coming at this in a spirit of positivity. We're going to work with Beacon Hill, whenever they're able to get their budgets out to try to sort this out. Obviously, schools, need as much information as possible. We need to know how many teachers to hire or not to hire. We need to be ready. But I think what's clear is we have to be flexible given the extreme circumstances. And that's kind of how we're going to approach this.
Okay, thank you,
Commissioner. I just saw one last question for the Commissioner since we have him for a couple more minutes, which is any more specifics on remote learning in the fall if there's a hybrid, and recognizing that some communities are more positioned than others to do remote learning. And so how would the approach be to provide resources across the state?
Sure, great question. What I would say is, we recognized early on that remote learning was going to be a necessity for some districts. We did not say remote learning is synonymous with online learning. And what I meant by that is we know there are some districts right now that have incredible broadband challenges due to geography, for instance, or they have device challenges or internet challenges. And we estimate the problem to be about a $50 million one. We are trying to, and we have been filling in some of those holes as we've gone along and been able to get funders to dig in and provide some of those devices and internet hotspots and the like. We're going to continue to do that. But obviously, we're looking for a bigger ask from foundations. We are likely going to use some of the CARES money that the state will take over, but there's going to have to be some additional dollars found, whether that's in a bond bill or through philanthropy. You know, there's going to have to be a greater push to get those dollars into districts. Now, let me also say this, and let me be clear. While the state is able to give some funding towards this, because individual districts have also been given CARES money, that money is supposed to go for these kind of things, right? I would say technology and PPE are two things that these dollars are supposed to go towards. So individual districts are also now able to fix a lot of the problems themselves. But we'll try to support as much as we can because we want to fix that problem. If, as you say, it becomes a need in the fall to do remote learning or a hybrid version of remote learning, where some of the kids go into school 1 week or, you know, and not the next, depending on what happens, there are different possibilities out there. But remote learning still might be on the table if there's a second spike, for instance, in cases and we have to go back out remotely. We want to be as prepared as possible for that. And so that work continues. Our remote learning group continues. And, you know, we've been working with philanthropies, vendors who are donating both devices and internet or severely reducing the cost of those things to try to make sure that we can solve that problem.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Turn it back to you, Lieutenant Governor.
Okay, I know that Secretary Theoharides is also available, but before going there, I just wanted to recognize the DLS director. There is a question around the Community Compact application and where that sits so that municipalities can access that. Where on the website is that?
Hey, Lieutenant Governor, it's Sean. Yeah, so the website that the individual put in the chat, once he or she is there, click on best practice and the grant application for the best practice program is right there. So one more click and he or she is there.
Okay, very good. Thank you for that clarification. Regarding the phases, both business activity as well as other activities, we wanted the secretary to come and talk a little bit more about that, as well as the food security program, which is announced today. And also, just before getting there, on phase one, there might be some questions around how that's going. And as we said earlier, as we enter into the potential start of phase two, we want to get both industries as well as you as municipal leaders ready for that. The way we do that is very similar to how other states have approached this, by putting together the industry protocol, which sets out the specific guidance for these activity and these workplaces so that the entities can get ready for it. And that will begin now, just starting to roll out that industry protocol. And we'll work with you, Jeff, and your team, and all of you to make sure that you have that in advance so that you can get ready as well. So in phase two, campgrounds, playgrounds, spray decks, pools, as well as athletic fields and courts and youth sports in a limited fashion, will be eligible for use and activity. So I'm going to turn it over now to Secretary Theoharides to talk a little bit more about that.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and thank you, Jeff and MMA, for hosting this. I am on an iPhone, so I'm hoping my connection is okay. At any
Perfect.
Rate, good, great. So I can't say enough how important the partnership with municipalities has been as we've worked to figure out outdoor resources. I think, you know, the LG and the governor know how important the access is to the outdoors right now, especially as we move into the summer months. And as a parent of three, I can certainly say that that's keeping us all sane these days. I think many outdoor activities are also really a major economic driver for many of our communities, whether it's the Berkshires or our beaches. So we pulled together an outdoor recreation task force a few weeks ago to develop these phases for outdoor recreation, and then to develop guidance associated with each of those phases. And we were lucky to have a number of municipal representatives, over 60 individuals total, working on a number of different areas, everything from parks to ecotourism to playgrounds. Also representation from athletic league officials, YMCA, Boys and Girls Clubs, Land Trust, Recreational Fishermen. It was a great group, and they are still working now on phase two guidance.
We can't hear you, Secretary, and we can't see you, but we have your name up on the screen. There you are.
Oh, sorry.
You're back.
I was getting a phone call. That must have been it. I apologize. So I was talking about beaches, but one of the things that I think is helpful to be clear about is that we never closed municipal beaches or other beaches down for our own facilities. We closed parking at beaches, and we restricted them to transitory activity. That has now been lifted, and so DCR beaches can open their parking, although that's a partnership between municipalities and the state, whether they decide to open their parking. And we are also opening up restrooms at state beaches and state parks. State parks have been open throughout the COVID pandemic, and are now opening with increased amenities, including restrooms and trash disposal, as well as picnic areas. And athletic fields and courts can be utilized for non-contact sports like tennis and handball. No shared equipment, no group gatherings. Playgrounds and pools are opening in phase two, and so that's something we're actively working on, developing the guidance around that. In phase one, many of our seasonal outdoor and recreational opportunities like adventure parks, whitewater rafting, and horseback riding are able to open with specific safety protocols, as well as zoos, wildlife reserves, botanical gardens, and outdoor public art installations. And we did see a number of those types of facilities opening up yesterday. We are also working with folks at early education and childcare and DPH on the intersection of different things like pools and playgrounds with summer camp and childcare generally. Marinas, boat clubs, and docks are all open. And we have provided additional guidance around boating. As the Lieutenant Governor said, charter fishing is allowed with up to 10 people total on board a vessel. And for recreational use, boat ramps across the Commonwealth managed by the state remain open. Importantly, they're open for vehicles registered in Massachusetts. And once again, and this is the case with all of our resources, boat ramps that are currently managed by municipalities remain open subject to the discretion of the city or town. And so we always want to hear from you all if you're having trouble with a facility or need assistance. And finally, so camping right now is allowed for members of the same household where there is a full hookup and self-containment available, like a self-contained RV or motorhome. In phase two, more traditional tent camping will open up. Fishing and hunting have been allowed throughout and will continue to be so. And in phase two, we are looking forward as well to opening youth sport leagues for practice, essentially, and drills limited to a team group coming together to practice. So I will stop there and happy to take questions. Jeff, I might need you to direct them to me just because I can't see them on my little screen from the chats. But I just wanted to say again how valuable it has been for us to hear from you all as we've developed this guidance and look forward to continued partnership.
Thank you very much, Secretary. It's great to have you here. And we do know that and also appreciate the deep involvement of municipal officials and practitioners in the development. A lot of the guidance and best practices that you've developed and are on the state website and we've pushed out to our members as well are very helpful, and especially the next level guidance for pools and playgrounds and summer camps will be, I'm sure, equally helpful, if not challenging to implement. I'm looking for questions regarding outdoor activities. And here's one that has come up. There's the order on gatherings of no more than 10 people in unenclosed outdoor space was clarified by over the weekend, I believe. But communities are still looking for guidance and suggestions in the policies regarding events such as outdoor concerts and the like. Do you have any guidance that you can add or drill down on for our members?
So those types of, what we consider larger scale gatherings are being contemplated as more of a phase 3 activity, but we are working on guidance for those types of activities. One of the things we did put out guidance on for phase 1 is group classes are available. So for example, a yoga class or a guided nature hike are available for groups of less than 10 of adults. So at this point it's adults only, but we do envision that expanding as the phasing continues, and would be happy to talk more about concert series and that kind of thing moving forward.
In another way to take a look at this, and I'll rephrase the question, mm-hmm. If social distancing is not possible in outdoor events, then those would not be allowed in phases 1 and 2. Is that correct?
Well, so there's elements of probably most or many outdoor activities where, temporarily social distancing may not be possible if, for example, you're walking on a small trail and need to pass someone or use a beach outhouse, that kind of thing. And so in those cases, we just ask people to abide by the governor's order on face coverings. So when you can't social distance, do wear a face covering. But in terms of bringing people together for larger activities where social distancing is not possible, those would be, yes, later phases.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Seeing if there are other questions regarding outdoor activity, can groups use fields for large scale non-contact activities? For example, holding programming that would not be considered a camp, but would be non-contact, lots of people outdoors.
So at the moment for our DCR facilities, we are not issuing permits for anything larger than a group of 10 adults for some type of small class. So in phase 1, we are not doing group activities on fields.
And then there's a question just to confirm that the beaches and parking guidance will be issued on a statewide basis as opposed to a regional basis for the state facilities. Is that correct?
So for state facilities, we updated an executive order from the governor that had closed state beach parking and had limited beaches to transitory activity only. So the order has been updated to allow for parking at all DCR state-owned beaches, inland and coastal. And so this is done on a statewide basis. And again, there are cases where parking won't be open, like in Revere and in the city of Boston with very crowded beaches. But most beaches will be opening a certain amount of their parking or full parking.
I see questions that are related, but I believe you've answered them in your introduction and then these questions. If someone feels as though I haven't, they can retype in the bottom of the group. Otherwise, the questions appear to go back more generally to the phasing and various activities. And I do know that we don't want this to be confusing, we'll say there are two DLSs involved. One is the Department of Labor Standards, and the director, Michael Flanagan, is available to answer some questions. And then also we have Senior Deputy Commissioner Sean Cronin from the other DLS that deals with all money matters and the Division of Local Services, and he's on board this briefing as well. Lieutenant Governor, is there anything you'd like to add before we go out to questions of the distinguished panelists that you've assembled for us?
There was a question regarding fireworks. I'm sure you received a lot of those kinds of calls, Secretary Theoretis. Any guidance there?
So I think we actually have surprisingly not received too many calls on this, but some. The most events are being canceled right now that we're seeing, and we think that fireworks would probably be something that would be similar to concerts and other things that would bring larger groups together, but it might be a phase two or a phase three thing. But another area where I think we could use input on what you tend to see at your fireworks displays in your communities. And I do think that would be guidance we'd put out phase two or three.
So for the 4th of July, it could be that there is a display, but no mm-hmm.
Yes, something like that could be possible, I think. Yep.
It's all events seem to be adjusting accordingly to the era that we live in. So fireworks from your car, maybe.
I do know that drive-in movie theaters were very popular yesterday. So
yes.
Yes.
In my childhood and today.
Yes.
So we actually have some questions regarding municipal operations. Lieutenant Governor, it's okay to segue to those because it'd be good to get some of those answers in before we rush toward the end. And this is a question that's directed to DLS Director Michael Flanagan from the Division of Labor Standards. And this has to do with the office space usage at Town Hall and City Hall and the 25% threshold or the exceptions or the flexibility that communities have to restore municipal operations in this phase with the office space guidelines that have been provided.
Hi, yep, this is Michael Flanagan from the Massachusetts Department of Labor Standards. So I'm happy to field any specific questions. In general, the municipal town hall or other buildings are required to meet the 25% requirement, but there's a lot of flexibility built into that. So it would depend a little bit on what the services are. Because it's an office by office requirement, not a building requirement. And I've sent out some information regarding how to make those calculations, but I can do that again, or like I said, if there's specific questions, I'm happy to field those.
In general, I think the clarifications of office to office as opposed to entire building is important, that if there are some essential functions that require a higher percentage of staff returning to the office above 25%, then that would be permitted as well. At this time, because the assumption is that the public is not, customer interactions are not taking place within town halls, similar to retail. Is that correct? And at what stage do you anticipate city and town halls opening to customer interactions, and what adjustments would need to be made then?
So I'm not familiar with what phase those interactions would be allowed. I think, again, there are some services that would be deemed essential by the town that could be open now. Most municipalities were given that latitude. So if there were some key elements that had to be done at the moment, then those would be allowed to be open now. Just as one, for instance, you might be looking at an emergency, you know, permit for a septic system that broke, or some other type of emergency permitting, which, you know, could potentially require in-person interaction. As much as possible, obviously, remote work is being encouraged, and doing things by email and finding new ways to do it. But some things, you know, you need a signature on. You can't help just doing it in person. So towns would have some flexibility in regards to those things.
Okay, let me add a little bit more, and I know that our legal office is on this call as well to add further clarification to that. So we at the state level are continuing to have our essential workforce operate in the manner that they are now, and including continuing to work remotely. That is an option for municipalities as well. And we are preparing, and maybe this has already been shared with you, I don't know, the staff will have to update me if I'm speaking incorrectly on this. We have guidance for the way state government is operating. So for instance, DCAM has guidance that it is preparing for state buildings and preparing that for how they're to operate when the public begins to engage in person for services, as well as for the workforce returning to those physical locations to provide government services. Also, similar guidance from the Registry of Motor Vehicles, for instance, is forthcoming, because they are a front-facing, public-facing operation that could also be helpful to you. And from our HRD, our Human Resource Department, to talk about, through guidance, what we're doing for our workforce as it begins to return physically back into work. But at this time, remote work is still active in state government. The legal team, anything to add to that?
I guess not. And if you're calling in by phone, *6 is the way to unmute. A question regarding the office space and the employer obligations. One local official asks whether the employer has the obligation to provide the face covering to the employees.
In a government setting?
Yes.
Well, that depends on the issue of social distancing, as well as the nature of the position. And the order is that you provide either social distancing or a face covering if social distancing is not feasible. And then there may be some categories of work that would require both, depending on the nature of the job.
And specific questions, communities can contact DLS, the Department of Labor Standards, directly with specific questions like that, I believe.
Right, so the way we structured the industry protocols once the phase is open, so we're in phase one, is to have a self-certification process. So we outline to the employer in that industry, these are the protocols that you need to address in order to be compliant with our mandatory safety standards. Very important. We want workers to feel confident and comfortable returning to work, as well as the public when you're opening to do business with a customer, for instance. The enforcement of that comes with joint enforcement authority between local boards of health and the Department of Labor Standards, and the Michael spoke to that. There will be issues that come up. Could be from a worker, could be from a customer. And most often they will call you, your board of health, and say, I'm concerned about this. This didn't seem right. And under both agencies, local as well as the state, there is authority to investigate. And then the investigation can lead to more education so that the employer does come into compliance. And if there is a resistance to becoming compliant, there are penalties associated with that offense. And these are civil fines that could be imposed depending on the circumstances involved. The goal for all of us is to help businesses and organizations reopen and make their workplaces safer. And it's a balance between the public health guidance as well as the workplace guidance in order to accommodate safe reopening, timely reopening within the phase, and then a joint authority to be able to enforce the rules so that these indeed are safer places. And at the same time we reopen, we need to continue to fight COVID-19 spread. So it's really important that we get employers comfortable, that they understand what the rules are and they adopt them.
And Lieutenant Governor, just because it's even more complicated in the public setting with cities and towns, it's great that we have some folks from the legal office here. Perhaps this question can be answered that has been posed in the chat regarding what a community can do if a resident is refusing to wear a face covering to enter a public building and does not have a medical condition, is just saying, I believe it's my right not to wear one, but potentially then exposing the employees. What can the community prevent someone, again, who does not have a legitimate excuse for wearing a face mask from entering a public building? And also communities have received guidance that communities cannot deny someone, for example, voting on election day if they refuse to wear a mask. Just to just see if we can have some legal. I see Elizabeth Denniston is unmuted.
Jeff, thank you. On the question of for public building purposes, it is at the discretion of the municipality if they choose, like businesses, if someone won't wear a face mask, you can refuse entry if you choose. On the question of polling places, which implicates a constitutional right to vote, we would defer to the Secretary of State's office and say that you should not refuse somebody the ability to vote who refuses to wear a face mask. You should encourage them, but you should not prevent them from being able to vote.
Very good. I hope that answers the question. Thank you very much. Let's see. Lieutenant Governor, here's obviously an issue, and we had the privilege of speaking about this earlier today, regarding restaurants and the outdoor option to open in the next phase. A lot of work is being put into development of the guidelines and the recommendations to ensure safety, but also to begin to open up that sector beyond just the takeout. Can you talk a little bit about the efforts that you are working to lead in terms of providing some flexibility on permitting and the need to provide innovative options for communities to just take advantage of the season and get going to help their restaurants?
Okay, yes, of course. We established a hospitality restaurant work group that includes municipal representation as well as the industry representation. And that was designed to inform us around the industry protocols for both restaurants and for hotels and lodging. We are in the process of developing that industry protocol, as we referenced earlier, and we'll be releasing that. Now, part of this comes with an enormous need to work in partnership with all of you, as you play an important role in approving licenses for, say, liquor, as well as Board of Health permits for restaurants. So the issue came up on the chat, I can see, relative to streamlining the process for reopening restaurants. So for instance, if a restaurant has only indoor capacity, but you as a community are working on creating outdoor venues for restaurants to be able to use, that there's a process around how to do that and how to alter or update their license to serve alcohol on premises when that premises is defined the way it currently sits as opposed to having outdoor capacity. So there's a lot of issues associated with how to do this. Senator Feeney's bill does address the ABCC process, which is that three-step process that can take upwards of 6 weeks. And municipals have raised that issue on this chat, as well as through MMA leadership, that is there a way to streamline that process so that when phase two does begin and it includes some restaurant use, could the sort of the rules be in place to allow for that to occur? So that can happen with either the legislature processing that bill with your support, or we're evaluating whether there's an executive order that can be made in order to allow for this streamlined permitting in the short term, and then allow the legislation to be processed to then be in place for that purpose. So that is an important matter under evaluation, and we're processing this now to allow for this reopening to occur in phase two in some fashion for restaurants.
And we appreciate that very much. We know there's a lot of work, and it's highly complicated because there's a state process and a local process. And so providing relief from the timelines and the hearing requirements that have to happen at the municipal level as well on permit amendments and so on, and licenses would be extremely helpful. And we look forward to continuing to work with you and your full administration on that. And we thank you. I am looking for, there's a number, let's see, is the secretary still on? I see her name, but not her face. If she's still on and able to answer a question, or maybe Sean Pierce, the assistant secretary, could. Here's a local mayor who had two requests to allow outdoor weddings and wedding receptions in early June. Is the 10-person limit still in effect, or can couples have more than guests as long as they're appropriate social distancing? One imagines this is in public public spaces.
Yeah, I can jump in, and Secretary, if you're still with us, please feel free. That outdoor weddings are actually one of the categories that really has some crossover between EOEEA and some of the other secretariats and agencies that are working with the Lieutenant Governor, with Secretary Keneally, Housing Economic Development, and the Reopening Advisory Board. So that is something we are actively working together on as we work our way through phase one into phase two.
Very good. I know that we've come up on the 2 o'clock hour. Lieutenant Governor, there are a few questions regarding pending legislation. And just to say that I will provide an update on that the legislation to provide time or relief rather from quorum requirements or allow remote representative town meetings and so on. Had not had any action as of 1 o'clock this afternoon in the House. It has already passed the Senate. That's now that we're entering June, a critically important piece of legislation for all those communities that want to hold town meetings.
And Jeff, I would just to jump in there, it's Elizabeth Denniston. I think we are seeing some movement on the House side, some promising signs. So please stay tuned. We're gonna keep working on getting that passed.
Excellent, and that's very important. We appreciate that support as well. And think that you've let us know that if that legislation in its current form makes it to your desk, then the ink from the legislature will not have dried before the ink from the administration is put on it, signing it. So we appreciate your recognition of the urgency for communities who are just trying to decide whether or not to hold their town meetings. And are also continuing to look for guidance because they're primarily indoor events, of course, as to when and how it would be safe to do that as well. Lieutenant Governor, I will, as always, make the note that there are some questions that we haven't had a chance to get to or would require more research. We will work with you and your team to research those and then put those on the MMA website and link to those in the future invitations for the ongoing briefings. So we appreciate that very much. Any closing words for us this afternoon as we are in the middle of implementation of phase one and starting to lean toward phase two? That means probably more than twice the standard workload, even during this pandemic. So
yeah, there's a lot that we need to work on together, as we can see. These are not easy decisions to make. It's complicated procedurally as well as substantively, and we want to continue to work with you. And I've heard many times from Jeff and others that the notice and the ability to prepare and plan is really important for the successful and safe reopening of activities and workplaces in your communities. So we'll continue to do that. And thank you. A lot of questions here. We will be sure to work with you in getting these answers out. And we really appreciate your willingness to be the communicator so the information does flow to the municipal leaders across your state. So thank you all very much. Really appreciate everything.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. And to everyone who has been participating in this briefing, thank you very much for joining. This is the 10th briefing that the Lieutenant Governor has provided to the municipal chief executive officers during this crisis, assembling the top members of the Baker-Polito administration to answer questions and to provide follow-up and ongoing communication. We will, of course, look forward to having you join us next Tuesday at 1 o'clock for the 11th briefing during the pandemic. Yet in the meantime, remind you that the municipal CEO briefing by the Executive Office of Housing and Economic Development on state grant opportunities to serve as a catalyst for economic activity and renewal during this crisis will be taking place Thursday at 1 o'clock. Every person who's been invited to this meeting has been invited to that webinar, and we very much appreciate the administration's putting that webinar together for local officials to provide key information about how to access those grant funds. This is primarily on non-CDBG non-entitlement communities, but also other programs will be covered. So we look forward to seeing you this week later, and then next week at the next briefing. Thank you very much, and have a good day.
Okay, thank you, everyone.
Thank you.